Hello, this is Best Practice. I'm Richard Adie. Sexual harassment has been making the news lately. High-profile figures are being brought to account. But are the stories in which high-profile men are called out for making unwanted advances, or worse, typical of what goes on? Come to that, what constitutes sexual harassment? If you're a manager, what's your legal obligation if it occurs? And how can you make it less likely to happen in the first place? Professor Sarah Charlesworth from the School of Management at RMIT University has the answers. She's conducted extensive research on this very issue.
Well, it's interesting. If you just read the media, you'd think that that was the only form of sexual harassment there is. But the Australian Human Rights Commission has been, since 2003, now doing a series of prevalence surveys, you know, so that they allow them to estimate how prevalent is sexual harassment in the workplace in Australia. And they also ask people who say they've been sexually harassed, for example, they ask them who the harasser was, what their relationship was in terms of organisational relationship. And what they've found for the last two surveys, so 2008 and 2012, is that just over 50% of the alleged harassers are in fact co-workers, peers.
That's interesting, because the
it's very interesting.
The narrative is all about a power dynamic, a power differential.
It is, which is not to say that working with peers doesn't have a power dynamic. What's interesting, certainly in the data and some of the complaints made to human rights commissions that I've had a look at, is that, for example, the less typical, but there is, you know, men get sexually harassed. They're much more likely to get sexually harassed by men in their workplace. While they might be peers, there's absolutely a power dynamic. So someone is bullied because of their sexuality, they're bullied because they don't display for that particular workplace the attributes of masculinity that are accepted. And so sexual harassment is used in quite a bullying way, but very directly by quite powerful co-workers. The fact someone's a co-worker doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't a power imbalance.
That's obviously very true. Now, what I think there is some lack of clarity on is the common understanding of what constitutes sexual harassment.
I agree absolutely. And I think one of the problems is that a lot of people think that it has to involve basically sexual assault, that you have to be grabbed sometimes subjected to kind of fairly revolting kind of verbal abuse, but often there's some kind of grabbing there. And once again, what the prevalence survey tells us is the most common forms of sexual harassment are in fact the suggestive comments, the so-called jokes. And they're the things that on the face they don't seem as serious as being grabbed or assaulted by someone, but they really wear the people who are in the receiving end of that kind of harassment down, that constant belittling.
Yes.
It's incredibly pervasive, and that's really, once again, in the last two prevalence surveys, and there's the next prevalence survey is due to be run in 2018, so it'll be interesting to see how that shows up there. But this, what a colleague and I have done a lot of work in this area, Paula McDonald from Queensland University of Technology, and I call it a kind of the classic version of sexual harassment. So, and it really shapes then what people think is sexual harassment. In the course of our research, Paula and I have interviewed people who've been sexually harassed, and often they may, well, sometimes they've spoken to people before, sometimes they haven't. But we always ask them, when it happened to you, did you think or did you know this was sexual harassment? And a lot of people where it wasn't physical assault or wasn't by a male boss in a very powerful position would say, well, no, you know, it made me feel creepy. It made me feel really uncomfortable. There was one young woman, for example, who I had a long telephone interview with, and she told me that she'd worked from the age of 15 in a regional town in the local supermarket, and there was a particular customer who would just always wait till he was on her checkout line. And he would just stare at her, do nothing else but stare at her. And she said to her manager, look, I feel really uncomfortable. And he said, don't worry about it. It's fine. He's a customer. That's your job. You've got to serve all sorts, etc. And it wasn't until he was waiting outside for her one day when she left work that she finally decided she had enough. And she said, that was, it doesn't sound like much, but if that's happening to you day in, day out when you go to work and you're made to feel nervous and uncomfortable, rather dreading as you see this chap you know, crossing lines to work out where you are and to kind of come through and just stare at you, that can be sexual harassment. But she actually said that she didn't see that at the time as sexual harassment. Mm. It was only when she was older and she realised that's what had happened, that it was sexual harassment. And that's because it didn't, in her mind, meet that kind of criteria of that classic form of sexual harassment.
The other thing, I suppose, is it can be so regular and prevalent that it becomes the normal thing.
Well, yes, it is. And then it's quite interesting, you know, when you have a look at some of these complaints or even some of the very few complaints that ever go to courts or tribunals, often the response is, but that's the nature of the workplace. You know, we've got a, you know, ribald humour in our workplace, and that's just what we say, and, you know, no one should take offence. That's just how we are.
They should learn to take a joke. I've actually heard someone say that about an incident.
And it's very frequently said, or that they're just too thin-skinned. But we have Rolls-Royce laws in Australia. If you're looking, if you're comparing, we've got 9 different anti-discrimination jurisdictions in Australia, but if you have a look at the federal law, for example, it really is not whether or not, if I'm the person doing the harassing, whether or not I think it's harassment. It's actually I'm supposed to take account of the sensitivities or how that person might feel. So if they're of a particular ethnic background, or if they're really young or really old, I'm supposed to have, you know, reasonably anticipated, if I could have been expected to reasonably anticipate that they might take offence or be, you know, humiliated or intimidated by what I do or say, then that is sexual harassment.
So what are the legal responsibilities for managers when it comes to sexual harassment in the workplace?
The strength of our laws is we have this idea of vicarious liability, so that when someone's sexually harassed at law, the presumption is that the employer is liable for that harassment unless they can show that they have taken reasonable steps. So what we do know from the court cases is over time, that's not just a matter of having, you know, a sexual harassment policy in a dusty old folder that never is used, but that the expectations of the courts, certainly in terms of what organisations need to do, are commensurate with the size and the sophistication of the organisation. So a large corporate organisation, etc., that's got, you know, for example, an HR department, is expected not just to, you know, have that policy, but to make it clear in their induction training, in manager training and line manager supervisor training, that sexual harassment won't be tolerated, and also make it very clear what the channels are for raising concerns or making a formal complaint within the organisation.
The ideal, of course, is to make sure it never happens. So what can be done in terms of prevention, policies and training that will work?
People, you know, zoom in on the sexual and sexual harassment. So they tend to think this is just something personal between maybe some badly behaved man and some poor, powerless woman. They don't actually see it's in the way that work is organised, in the way roles are filled, the opportunities that people who aren't men, and there's lots of men who, there are still men who get sexually harassed because, as I said, they don't behave in the way that men are supposed to behave, so that they might be called, you know, a poofter, for example. You often read that in the complaint files, that will be used as a way to kind of try and demean someone. So I think it's very important that there is a public culture of no tolerance for sexual harassment, but also, and this is very interesting because universities, as you will be aware, have been involved in the big survey that was done of student sexual harassment and sexual assault on campus. And one of the most effective things, certainly in my university, that's coming out of that is really focusing on the bystanders. How can we equip not just the person who's the subject of that particular sexual harassment, but people around them or people that they tell, how can we equip them to be able to recognise it when it happens, call it out, so that if someone does tell the joke, to say, well, actually, I don't think that's not appropriate here. People don't need to make a song and dance, because the one thing that people who've been harassed don't want is to be the subject of lots of attention. They just simply want the behaviour to stop. Focusing on that kind of broader systemic approach is really very important. And it's just part of treating people with respect. It's pulling it back and not just saying you mustn't sexually harass people, but you have to treat people properly. Yeah, you have to treat them as you would want to be treated.
So part of the culture, make it, and with the same, putting it in the same place as we put other bullying. So
Exactly. It's a particular type of bullying, but it's often, and this is for being an academic who's worked in this area, I mean, often what is striking is there's sexual harassment, but there's also sex-based harassment, and often the two kind of meld so that you're getting harassed because you're the only woman, for example, in a particular area, and it's really to keep you in your place. The idea that seems to be out there in the ether is that sexual harassment is about, you know, uncontrolled sexual desire, just I don't think holds up. It is used often in an extremely bullying way to, you know, actually remind people of their place in that organisation, in that particular kind of work site, for example.
Mm.
And, you know, and it tends to have the very effect that is being sought by the person doing the harassing. Because if you talk to people who've experienced that harassment, it is feeling that loss of self-esteem, loss of confidence. You know, people will say, I was a bit like that young woman I told you about. Look, I was just really uncomfortable. I just thought it was creepy. And people don't know what to call it. They really need to have somebody they can say, look, this happened, and someone to say to them, well, you know, that does sound a bit like sexual harassment. What do you want to do? Because people
That's the key, isn't it?
It is.
Listen and believe.
It is. Believe, this is, and Paula and I interviewed quite a few people who deal with the kind of wash-up of investigations gone sour within organisations. And they often start from just treating, well, these two people, it's he said, she said, for example. Instead of just saying, look, I can see you're terribly upset, tell me what's happened. Okay, it does sound a bit like, you know, sexual harassment from what you're saying, or it sounds exactly like sexual harassment, depending on what the person's, you know, telling you. What can we do about it? What do you want to do? Often what people want is the acknowledgement, A, it's sexual harassment, B, it's wrong, and C, that that behaviour is not tolerated within the workplace. And that's as far as they want to take it.
They don't just want the policy read out, do they? They want something done about it.
Don't want the policy read out, but sometimes they will also want an apology, and that's what's kind of fascinating in a ghastly way, because that's usually the thing that employers and HR departments fight not to provide. People just want, you know, not the kind of Clayton's apology, I'm sorry that you seem to think that you've been sexually harassed, but we're really sorry that that happened. We realise that that, you know, can have devastating impact on you, and let us know what we are able to do. What do you want to do in this circumstance? And different people will want different things. Some people will say, look, I really, you know, want you to be able to call in the person who I've said who's harassed me and talk to them, or, you know, I want a kind of mediated thing where we can sit down and talk about this. But most people want it sorted when it happens.
I am impressed that anybody has the gumption to make a fuss about it, if you know what I mean. I've had a bit in the past to do with whistleblowers. They're overwhelmingly motivated to act because something's very wrong, and they've usually tried to make it right and they've been ignored, and then they blow the whistle. And it ends up, without fail, being much harder on them than it is on anyone else.
And that's exactly what happens when you take a formal complaint of sexual harassment. The cases that go to the Equal Opportunity Commissions that end up in the courts and tribunals are less about the actual harassment, but the way they've been treated by the organisation. So that's the thing that really galvanises people to seek external redress, some kind of acknowledgement that they've been done wrong. But quite frankly, by that time, that's so far down the road that, as you say, with whistleblowers, there's very little satisfaction out of that. There's really, if we were able to act immediately when somebody comes forward and just says, look, I'm made to feel uncomfortable, you know, I don't like the way he or she speaks to me. I don't like the way that they talk about their personal life, for example, in the staff room. That makes me feel uncomfortable. Then it's far easier for the manager or the line manager to say, well, look, you know, guys, in our workplace, we need to have a bit of a conversation about what's appropriate and what's not appropriate when we're at work.
Sarah, I really appreciate you joining me on Best Practice today.
It's a pleasure.
Sarah Charlesworth, professor in the School of Management at RMIT University. I spoke to her via Skype. If you've experienced sexual harassment at work, Sarah's advice is to talk to someone, either at your workplace or to friends or family. The other thing you can do is call the Equal Opportunity Commission in your state or the Fair Work Commission. You'll find contact details and further information on the Best Practice homepage at abc.net.au/rn. On RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts, I'm Richard Adey. This is Best Practice. What do CEOs do all day? That's the question Rafaela Sadoun asked, and to answer it, the Associate Professor at the Harvard Business School, together with colleagues from Columbia University and the London School of Economics, has surveyed 1,200 chief executives across 7 countries. And the question? How do you spend your time? Well, it probably comes as no surprise to learn they spend a hell of a lot of it in meetings. But the sort of meetings they are and who they're meeting are crucial. To explain, here's Rafaela Sadoun.
What we find in the data is that there is lots of variation across CEOs in the way in which they structure their meetings. And what I mean by that is we have one type of CEO, you know, it's much more focused on coordinating high-level meetings with, when we say high-level, it's typically meetings with their peers, people who are in the C-suite, and they bring together multiple functions at the same time. Typically, these meetings would be longer and would be more structured. And then at the other hand of the spectrum, we find managers that in spite of them being at the top of the organization, being CEOs, they still spend a lot of their time working in operational meetings. They mostly interact with production. I have to say this sample is mostly based of manufacturing, entirely based actually of manufacturing companies. So production is really an important component of what they do. But we see CEOs spending a lot of their time with production on the shop floor and in meetings that are often, you know, less structured, less planned than the other coordinator type.
One group is you're calling leaders and the other managers. So which is which?
The leader type is the type that is more involved in meetings that are coordinative, structured and with multiple functions at the same time. The manager is the type of CEO that spends most of his time in meetings with production, dealing in operational matters.
Did you find that there's managers at some sort of companies and leaders at others, or was it a genuine mix?
I think what we find is intuitive in the sense that there is a lot of these differences that we see across managers and leaders actually reflect differences in the nature of the organization that they lead. So there is a tendency, for example, for leaders to be found in companies that are larger or more complex, meaning that, you know, they span across different countries, for example. Whereas it's more likely to find managers in companies that are simpler, that perhaps are smaller or primarily involved in domestic operations. When I say it's intuitive, I think if you think about what the coordinator do, basically they have to deal with probably very different problems relative to the manager. So the first cut is that basically what the CEO does is to some extent a reflection of what the firm needs. And that's, I think, one of the main findings of the research. We also found differences in performance across companies that we believe reflect the fact that sometimes even companies that are large enough or complex enough to require more of this leader style, more hands-off coordination, are actually stuck with a manager. And so you have basically a situation in which the company would require more coordination, but you still have a CEO that is very involved in operations. And in the research, what we argue is that this is potentially a sign of a mismatch between firms and CEOs.
It sounds like the two roles are about addressing different levels of size or complexity.
That's absolutely right. There is an element of that for sure. And some people would define this as a situational leadership. Your behavior has to map the nature of problems that you have to deal with. And I think that our research confirms that perspective on the activity of CEOs.
So which ones, I'm thinking it has to be the leaders, because larger companies are often more productive. But are they the more productive sorts of CEOs?
Yes. On average, we definitely find that there is a productivity premium associated with having a leader CEO. But this, as you correctly mentioned, doesn't necessarily mean that it's the CEO causing the productivity premium. To some extent, it's a reflection of certain types of firms selecting different type of leadership styles.
So is there a kind of easy way to say, well, this kind of company requires a manager style CEO and this one requires a leader?
I think one of the most important variables I would definitely look at is company size. It's also, I think, important to look at the level of expertise that it's needed in the company to produce. And this is something that we find in the data. Companies that are in industries which are more skill intensive, that require more of this expertise, tend to be associated with more of this leader style, where their job is primarily to combine different types of skills together. So for me, the two variables that are of absolute importance is one, size, and second, the skill intensity of production.
And I suppose a kind of proxy for that is if a company is large and complicated, what a CEO ends up doing with most of his or her time is making decisions about the allocation of capital.
It might be allocation of capital. It's definitely resource allocation. I actually think that it can be broader than just capital. It can be allocation of resources in terms of human capital as well. But there is also a second element. And, you know, this, I think it's something that we speculate on more than measure with the data. But there is also an element of joint problem solving that I think it's part of the activity of the CEO. We tend to think of CEOs as individuals that have all their truths in their minds. But I think in reality, what happens in organizations is that the CEO doesn't hold necessarily all the information or all the knowledge to make a decision. And having this coordination of activities, coordination of ideas across people is also part of their job description.
I think there's an increasing awareness that that is the case. Now, I suppose the big question is, can somebody who is a manager actually become a leader CEO?
That's a fascinating question. It's not something I can address with the data that we collected. But I do believe that there are definitely margins for change. One necessary step, which is actually something that surprised me as we were conducting this study, is how little people know about their own time allocation. I think I tend to agree with you that change is possible. It's not just a matter of personality. But for change to happen, you have to have awareness. And in fact, through our study, we realized that there was often a very deep misunderstanding from the executives themselves on where their time was going or even how long they were working. You know, I teach MBAs and I teach executives. I think one immediate advice would be keep track of what you do. And first of all, monitor whether what you do aligns with what you want to achieve. I don't think many people do that today.
I think most of us could learn from that, actually. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Rafaela Sadoun, Associate Professor at the Harvard Business School. I spoke to her via Skype. On next week's show, you'll meet a man with one of the most challenging and unusual jobs in the country. Alan Cooper's the Chief Executive of the largest council area in Australia, the Shire of East Pilbara. It's a vast place with a tiny population. I hope you can join me for that. Best Practice is produced by Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is Judy Rapley. I'm Richard Adie.